In today's podcast, we're joined by the strong, the mighty, the Scotland team captain, Sione Tipilotu.
I can't tell you how I'm feeling right now. My voice's already gone.
Tipilotu breaks one tackle. Tipilotu.
Sione, look at that. Tipilotu right on cue. Just running around the defenders and through them.
I had a gut feeling that Scotland was the place for me, and I chose Scotland.
No, Tipilotu has made another
There's the Six Nations coming up, the biggest tournament, and you've snapped it. Like, what was going on in your brain at that point?
For the first 2-3 weeks, well, I've never been that dark in my career, partly because I'd never been hurt like that. My headphones were on at training and I wouldn't speak to anyone.
Is that where the faith came into it?
Being around my cousin, I got to see, you know, the real power of faith, and not having to seek applause or gratification from anyone else other than God, you know?
What does it take to be a captain, do you think?
Oh, geez, man, that's a big question.
Before we start this podcast, if you could do me a huge favor and hit that 5-star button, follow button, subscribe button, whatever it is, wherever you are, I'd really appreciate it. It honestly helps us so much more than you know. And the more 5 stars, follows, subscribes we get, the more incredible guests we can get on the Into the Mind podcast. My name is Harrison Brown, and this is the Into the Mind podcast. And without further ado, let's get on to this conversation with Sione. So much to talk about, mate.
Yes, brother.
So much to talk about. So I think that to start with, the most, like, the one that I was thinking of, Six Nations. What happened?
Mate.
What happened?
I can't, I've gotten over it now in terms of missing out on the tournament and everything, but when it all happened, I can't tell you. Like, I'm at the point now where, like, I sympathize with the boys that have had long-term injuries. Like, my injury's only been 3-4 months and I'll be back, you know? But there's lads that have been out for a year and, you know, sometimes just over a year. And I really sympathize with those lads and what they've had to go through, you know? And just mentally, really. You know, we're wired to want to compete every day. And when you're rehabbing, it takes that part of your life away, if you know what I mean.
Is it mentally more taxing? Like, I think
way more mentally taxing. Yeah. Than the game. Yeah. Than like when you're playing, because everything's very tedious. Mm. But also, like, you also have no release, if you know what I mean. Like, when you get to play,
yeah, it's like going to the gym. You get a release.
Exactly. On Saturdays, you get to go out and hit things, and that's your release, you know. And then you reset after that. But
yeah.
Rehab and stuff like that, you're kind of constantly working towards something a bit further in the distance rather than just Saturday.
Yeah.
You know? So that's all been a learning thing for me. And then watching all the Six Nations game as well, it was just hard, you know? Like, and, you know, but by the end of the tournament, I was real proud of the lads. You know, obviously a couple of the results didn't go our way and it was a little bit more disappointing than what we had hoped for. But, you know, some of my best mates got an opportunity to play while I was hurt as well. So I was real proud of them as well. So it was bittersweet in that way.
It was, yeah. And what happened? Like, you're with pectoral, am I right in saying it's pectoral muscle?
Yeah.
You just tore it? Like, do you have any inclination as to what went wrong?
Genuinely, mate, I've been through every scenario. like, did I turn the kettle on wrong that morning? Or just an action. Did I sleep on it weird that night? Yeah. I never thought my first major injury, like 10 years into my pro career, would be a pec. You know, like, if anything, like the one good thing that I'm good at in the gym is bench, you know? So like maybe I've just done it too much where it's just like, it was exhausted. I can't put my finger on it, mate, but it was all a massive shock. I knew I'd done it straight away as well.
Did you like feel a snap?
I felt it straight away. It was like, doof, doof, like, and I was just like, geez, that's not good. And then I'd gone inside and you're very delusional, you know? Yeah. Like I was looking, there was a hole in my armpit, like a hole. And I was like, No, it just must be cramping.
Yeah.
So like I was all very rushed and I rushed away from the physio room and I drove home with my boots on. Because I was in a daze almost and I didn't want it to be true. And then I got home and I was doing push-ups and I was going, oh no, I'm fine, you know. I was trying to convince myself I was all good, but deep down you know when you're hurt, you know? And so that all happened and I'm on the home stretch now of returning. So that's all in the past now. And if anything, I feel like well, obviously I haven't played yet and I won't know, but I feel like it's probably given me another layer,
yeah.
you know what I mean, of my game, and because now it's made me like desperate to yeah. play, you know, like
yeah, yeah, you're like rearing to go again,
yeah, and like when you're in a long season as well with Glasgow and with for Scotland and everything like that, sometimes your body's tired and things like that. I've had 3 months where I've just been working on my body, you know, and I'm so starving now to perform and play to what I know I can play at, that like maybe this is elevated my game. That's the way I look at it, you know, rather yeah. than taking away from it, you know. So yeah, it's been a learning curve for me, definitely, just with the whole rehab journey, but I'm on the home stretch now and my mindset's very different.
Good. Well, I'm glad to hear that. But like, in terms of, so when that happened, you've messed up your arm or your like pec, there's like a hole in your arm, you know that the Six Nations is what, a week later?
A week later, yeah.
Jesus.
The funny thing is I was in a double rest week heading into the first game of the Six Nations because Franco had given me a week off of that week against Harlequins, and then the following week I wasn't going to play against Connacht because they were going to rest me for the Six Nations.
Yeah.
So I had 2 weeks to rest effectively before the first game, and I did it at training, which is crazy. I can't even believe it, but you know, I've looked back at it and I was like, maybe I was training too hard or competing too hard, but you can't think of that, you know. That's kind of like what's got me to that point, is competing like that, you know, and have maybe training on the edge sometimes. So yeah, it's like I said, it's not, if anything, I feel like it's going to elevate my game coming back from this injury.
Do you have any anxiety? Like, because I remember I buggered my back up, and ever since then, deadlifts have been, I've been like, oh, this is, it might be the time it goes.
Yeah.
Like, do you have any time when you're benching that you're like, oh,
definitely. I'm much more careful. Like, take it this way. I used to be a guy that walked in the gym and I wouldn't warm up anything. You know, like my body's just been so good to me over my career that I would walk in the gym. I'd be a bit sore, but once I got into, you know, lifting, I'd be able to lift heavy. And I always just felt like that was, you know, like that was just me. That's how I was built, you know, but ultimately that's not, you know, like, and maybe it's a learning curve for me that I needed to, you know, get on the bands and stuff like that before before I get into the gym. But yeah, I suppose this is how it's happened.
Like mentally, so take me back there's the Six Nations coming up, the biggest tournament, and you've snapped it mentally. Like, because a lot of athletes do this when there's a couple of things that happen. Either they get injured, they actually win, or they can't compete for some reason, personal reasons, and everything they've worked for, for the last 2 years, is stripped like that.
Yeah.
From like circumstances they can't really control.
Yeah.
And that can fuck with your head.
Yeah.
Like, what was going on in your brain at that point?
Yeah, it did with mine, to be completely honest and vulnerable. For the first 2-3 weeks, well, I've never been that dark in my career, partly because I'd never been hurt like that in terms of injury. But that's why I say I sympathize with those lads that have been out for a year. And, you know, even my little brother's done 2 ACLs before the time he's 20.
Both of them?
Same knee, but he's done 2 ACLs, you know? Jesus. 2 ACL surgeries before the age of 20. So these things are not easy to come back from, especially, you know, the long-term ones. So it was really hard for me mentally. And I think the one thing that I found probably the hardest is when you're playing footy week in, week out, you're always around the boys, if you know what I mean? Like, whether you're on the road to go play, for example, in the Six Nations, you stay in the same hotel as these boys for 8 weeks, you know? And I think one of the parts in rehab or long-term rehab that people underestimate is like the loneliness of it.
Yeah.
Over that first 3 weeks, I can't tell you, the boys will tell you, I went into like Bane mode, where I was like, my headphones were on at training and I wouldn't speak to anyone, you know, because I was so down bad that like mentally, you know, that I just didn't want, I wanted to sort it out with myself. And you don't realize, and that's where your partner comes in and your family, that, you know, this comeback is largely, when I do come back, you know, I feel like she should get a lot of, my partner Lara should get a lot of the credit, because like I said, the loneliness of it is, the boys got to keep trotting because there's more games to play, you know? Those lads got to keep going and try and win games for a club or country, you know? And they can't stop to
think about
it. It's not so much comfort you, but it's just like be around you. They're on tour, you know? And that's where your missus comes in, or for me, my son come in and my family came in. And that's why mentally I feel like I'm almost rebuilt, is that like, I've confided in them now probably more than I did pre-injury, you know, and they're the ones that help you get back on your feet, you know, mentally. Yeah. And they're the ones that push you on when things aren't going right. Because, you know, I would say probably the start of that year, that first 6 months of this season was probably the best of my career. And you're flying, you feel like everything's on the front foot. But, you know, maybe this is the way I look at it, is that maybe I needed to give a little bit more attention to other things in my life. And, you know, I believe in God and I have a strong faith that sometimes these things happen in my life so I can, maybe a few things are off, you know, he's telling me things.
It's like a reset.
It's like a reset, exactly. Right. And I've tried to use that time, you know, as best as I can, I suppose, to use that time, you know, to be more present as a father, be more present as a partner and stuff like that. And yeah, I've really enjoyed it, to be honest. And it's given me peace as well. It's just being around my partner and my child.
What do they mean to you, your partner and your child?
Oh, genuine. Everything. Genuinely, I know everyone says that, but, you know, before I had my son, there's a lot of things that my father taught me when I was young or my mother taught me that don't really make sense yet. And you go against all those things. And they tell you that all the way through your growing up. You're like, you don't understand now, but you'll understand later. And I think having my son at the time that I did was at the perfect time of my career, because there's a lot of stuff I didn't understand. And I was just I would say I was a rugby player before I was, you know, a family man. And now those things are opposite for me, and I'm a family man first, you know, before I'm a rugby player, before I'm a Scotland player, before I'm a Glasgow player, before all of that, I'm a father and a partner. And yeah, I think this period has taught me that, you know, that's the most important thing in my life. And I have to prioritize those two things more than anything, you know. And yeah, and like you say, I've learned that when all the chips are down, the boys have to, you know, like, you don't have...
Your support system is your family almost.
Exactly. Yeah, my support system is my family, you know. Yeah. And of course, my best mates, they're always there. My family, teammates, they're always going to be there. But your real support system when all the chips are down is your family. You know, they're the ones that are always going to be there for you, whether you're going well or where you're not going well. Mm. So I think that's really important for all athletes to know, because we get put in this... such a hot, you know what I mean? Like, everyone looks at us like, you know, our life's unreal, and people look up to us, and you inspire so many young kids and everything like that, that you can't forget what's, you know what I mean?
What's
like,
important.
What's important almost. Yeah.
Well, people almost get too trapped in the kind of, it's like the Conor McGregor thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
He got so sucked into like, I am the notorious that all of a sudden he starts doing things that are against, like, really immoral, like against his family, and he's no longer, now he can't perform as much anymore. But I'm sure that if he kept on the straight and narrow, he probably would have been able to perform. I mean, he's 35 or 36. Like, probably
still
would,
now.
Yeah, he's probably still would have been able to perform. Now, it's funny, like, a lot of the rugby boys seem to have gone, they have this, I've talked about this in another podcast, there's this stigma about mental rugby lads.
Yeah.
But actually it's not, like, when you look at Hugh or when you look at you, Finn's had two kids now.
Yeah.
Like, you're all pretty like family centric.
Yeah.
And actually I think that's quite like a nice thing. Do you see a change? Like, see, comparatively to the previous generation of rugby players, do you think they were a little bit more of that mental kind of going out vibe?
Yeah. Probably, like, when I first went to the Rebels, I was young at that time. I couldn't, it's not, when you're young, you think everything's so professional, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
and like,
like,
and to be honest, mate, like, I wish I could sit here and be like, I didn't want, you know, the career path I chose until later, you know, but I had made my mind up that I wanted to play rugby professionally early days, you know, and I had sacrificed a lot of stuff and, to get there. But then when you get there, you realize things are maybe not as professional as they, as you made out to, you know, these guys to be.
It's like the swan analogy. It's like, if you see a bit, I say this so much. Yeah. If you see a business from the outside, it's like a swan. It's like this majestic beast, but underneath you've got the fucking legs there.
Going crazy.
That's kind of what it's like. I think.
Yeah. Yeah. A little bit. And, I think now though, it is changing a little bit, probably. They're still wild boys and stuff like that. And I've been wild in my career, you know. There's a time and place for everything, like but I think now, well, I also look back at my career as well, is that when I was at the Rebels, I also had like a lot of, there were a lot of family men as well. And I always found, the one thing that I found so interesting is like, in rugby circles, it's always the thing of like the lads, you know what I mean? Like who can drink the most or...
drink out your shoe.
You know what I mean? Or like do the most, I don't know, masculine thing. But the one thing that I did find is like all those guys got the applause in the short temporary time, right? Like maybe on that day. But if you ask all the players that were finishing up their career who they respected the most, it was always the family men, if you know what I mean? And that kind of like had an impact on my brain anyways, is that like... when it's all said and done, sometimes as rugby players, we do things to impress our teammates or whatever. I want to be the guy that goes out every weekend or whatever and brag about it or whatever. But I found anyways, the ones that get all the respect is like the real family men, you know, or the honourable men or whatever. And, you know, I look at guys back in my career, like Marika Korobeti, I was with him and at the Rebels and just the way he like, conducted himself as a man, and forget about him as a rugby player. You know, he was one of the best rugby players that I've ever come across, but people respect him more because of how he operated as a man when everything was going so well. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
It's easy to do, I believe it's easy to do it when you're maybe not going so well because, but when you're getting everything, you know what I mean? At the top of your game, endorsements, you've got money, all these things, you know, and then you still hold yourself accountable, you know, to be a good person.
It's not letting your ego get away with you.
Exactly. Yeah. And I always found like, if you go, all the boys that played with Marika during that time, they always say that about him. He gets the respect, you know, for being being a good family man. I think that's what I want to strive to be, you know? Yeah. That's just kind of how I look at it now as being a rugby player and a family man at the same time.
You mentioned there that there was a lot that you sacrificed when you were kind of younger. And I was looking into your younger career. It was like Australia, then it was Japan, then it was Scotland. The three most polar opposite places you could get, like literally. So talk me through the kind of early career into Japan. And then how did the Scotland thing come about?
So early career, geez. I played junior footy at Southern Districts in Frankston. That's my hometown.
Right.
In Melbourne. I played there just club footy from about 12 to 15. And then basically I got a scholarship to St. Kevin's, which is a private school in town.
Okay.
Which is actually by public transport is how I was getting to school. It's about an hour and a half one way, on the train. So I was spending like over 3 hours on the trains every day just to get to school.
Your mum or your dad, you were living with your mum and your dad?
I was living with my mum and dad in Frankston, but both of those, they were working. It's not like they're going to drive me an hour and a half into town. Right, I would just jump on the train.
Yeah.
And I'd get in. It was actually, to be honest, some of my best memories of school was on the train. It was actually funny. I would jump on the trains with all the tradies that would go work. So they'd all be getting on with their high vises and their, you know, Eskies with their lunch because they'd be working in town. Yeah. So we'd be getting on the same train at 5:30 or 6 a.m. to go to school. I was going to school, but I got to know all the tradies and they got to know me because our blazer was real fancy. It's like candy cane striped blazer. So like I got to know a couple of the tradies. We would yarn on the train. I'd see them in the morning and then, you know, they'd wish me a good day at school, tell me to stay in school and everything. And it was just, I've said it a lot, but going to that school in a lot of ways saved my life. I think I was getting into a lot of trouble before I went to that school, just in my hometown and going to school around there. I was being influenced, you know, to go into different directions and probably directions that would have hurt my future. You know what I mean? And then when I got the scholarship to St. Kevin's, you're on the trains for so long trying to get to school. There's no time to spare, you know, like I was coming home and sleeping, you know, because after training, you finish training at 6 p.m. You're on the trains back home. You're not getting back home till 8. And you got to wake up and do it again at 5:30 the next morning. There's no time to muck around. So it saved my life in a lot of ways because it made me busy. And then I got, you know, I would say my first 2 years of that school were like teething years. Like I didn't see, none of the kids were like me there, you know, or at least in my head, you know.
Do you really think they didn't like you or do you think that?
No, I said none of them were like me.
Okay.
So like, I just didn't see myself in any of those kids there. Well, no, none of those kids were from Frankston to start with. Like, I had a chip on my shoulder, basically. I was still getting in trouble at school. There were times where the St. Kevin's wanted to get rid of me. And the part that saved me was I had a couple of really good teachers that...
pulled you out of it.
Pulled me out of it, but also gave me, like, mentorship, you know? Like, yeah. One of them's name's Bob Windle, who actually went to Merkinston here in Scotland, which is crazy. He kind of took me under his wing, and he was the first 15 coach, and he was my tutor at school, and his influence over me was massive. He got me competitive with my academics, which is something that I never was. I was always good at school, but I never tried, you know? And
so you were naturally quite talented. Like, you were naturally smart.
But I was naturally smart, I would say, but I never cared about school.
Right. Okay.
You know?
Okay.
And I would show up and do well on tests when I needed to do well on tests, you know? Yeah. But he got me real competitive with school, and he basically, I think in my mind, like, I know this is extreme, but it's the way that I think that he really raised me through those years. Is like, have you heard the story about Customato and Mike Tyson?
Yeah.
How Cus, it was more of a mental warfare on Mike Tyson to make him believe that he was someone.
He hypnotized
him. Exactly, almost hypnotizing them, you know, by like constantly telling them every day that you're good, you're really... you're talented, blah, blah, blah. And it slowly turns your mind to believing it, you know? And I would say, obviously, it's not as extreme as Mike Tyson, the baddest man ever, but the way he would talk to me every day made me believe that I could be someone, you know? Like, I could, in my academics or in my rugby especially. And he got me competitive with school. He started, like, I was always competitive in sport because I was very good at it, you know what I mean? But putting time into school and stuff like that, he made it almost like a sporting environment for me. He's like, you got to beat that kid, you know, in your grades. And then I started to do that. My mind started to be wide at doing good with my academics and stuff like that. Yeah. And it's all down to him, really, and his guidance over me. So it's just funny how certain people can have such an impact in your life at the right time.
At the right age. Yeah. It's like, we see when you're really young like that as well, a teacher can make a huge difference.
Massive, mate. Yeah.
Huge difference. Like, I had a teacher that told me that she was... absolute cow of a lady, I'll just say it now, but she said to me, she was like, yeah, you don't really need to try here because you're not going to university anyway because your grades are too shit.
Yeah, right. And that, like, has an impact on you, you know?
But for sure. But like, after that, a bit like yourself, you said you've got like a chip in your shoulder. After that, you start trying to prove them wrong.
Yeah.
So almost in like an indirect way, it's kind of a good thing because you try and be like, you know what, fuck you, I'm actually going to do well here.
Yeah.
Do you think that was part of it?
Yes, but I think more the encouragement to do it, if you know what I mean.
It was do you want more coffee, by the way?
No, I'm good, thanks, mate. I don't want to say too much about my old school because I never blame the teachers there for maybe not putting in as much effort as the teachers that at St. Kevin's did, if you know what I mean.
Private school, right?
Private school at St. Kevin's, where my school back home was a public school. And like, some of the things that I watch kids do to teachers at my old school, like, I don't blame them when the bell rings, they're getting out of there. You know, like, I generally don't blame them. And there were some really good teachers at my old school that would stay. But like, a lot of those teachers, I felt anyways, and this was my experience, they were there to make money, like
wasn't what they wanted to do, but they had to do it, maybe.
Yeah, I don't want to speak for someone, and because that's maybe someone's career, you know, like, I don't want to say that, but it just felt at that time they weren't as invested in kids as much as the teachers when I went to St. Kevin's were, and in particular Mr. Windle. Like, he was more concerned that I was going to do well in life rather than I was going to behave in the classroom, you know?
More like long-term view almost.
Exactly. And like, if you look at the hours that Mr. Windle would obviously do a normal day of school, but then he would teach me rugby after school, and then some days after that, stay and help me with my homework or my studies, which is like all the way up to like 7:30, 8 p.m. He's getting home at 8:30, 9 p.m. You know, which I'm not too sure how they get paid, but I'm assuming he's not getting paid.
No way.
You know what I mean?
That's incredible.
And he's doing that out of the goodness of his heart, you know, to make sure that I do well, you know? So it's more that I think that sense of someone caring made me focus, because I didn't want to let him down, if you know what I mean? And yeah, I always just say that, that it's just the timing of his influence on my life is just massive, you know?
Have you met him since then?
I still talk to him pretty much daily, weekly.
Do you?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, he's, like I said, he's been my mentor throughout my life. And
yeah.
I've always tell him when I come up to contract situations, I always bell him and ask for his advice and stuff like that. And he's been in my life since what now? I was 14 years old. He's been in my life ever since. Mm. It's 12 years almost, or 14 years now of friendship, you know?
Yeah. That is incredible though. That is what teaching should be.
Yeah, definitely. There
should be those lifelong, you know, relationships.
Yeah, you want to see the kids that you're teaching go on, you know,
and do amazing work.
Yeah, exactly. I'm so thankful for his influence on my life.
And did you, after that, so you had that influence, when did it come to be that you went to Japan?
Yeah, so basically I did 4 years at the Rebels.
Right.
The first 2 years of the Rebels were a dream come true. It's my hometown club.
Mm.
I became the first Melbourne kid ever to play for the club. My youngest kid to ever play for the club. And those 2 years were some of the best of my career. And I got to play with some of my closest mates. And I loved the club so much, you know. Mm. And for whatever reason, the 2 years after that were the worst of my career. And basically, to put a long story short, a new coach had come into the environment. For whatever reason, me and that coach didn't see eye to eye. Mm. And those next 2 years became really hard for me. I wasn't playing a lot. I was doing things off the field that I probably shouldn't have been doing out of anger, really.
Yeah. Out of spite to him.
Out of frustration. Not out of spite to him, but out of frustration, because I don't think I was built up. I don't think I was ready or mature enough at that point for someone to tell me I wasn't good enough.
Yeah.
You know, and I went the other way, you know, like instead of maybe putting my head down and it wasn't so much, but I had felt that I'd done everything to show this guy that I was good enough, but there was a bridge there, you know what I mean? That we couldn't close. And like I said, over that next 2 years, I was doing stuff that I wasn't supposed to be doing off the field.
Mm.
I was drinking heaps. I was, just not doing the stuff that got me there, you know? And like I said, I was a really disciplined kid in terms of my training and everything like that. And I think I lost myself in that next 2 years in the love for rugby. And that's where Japan came in. I got an opportunity to go over and play for Yamaha, which is in Shizuoka, which is about an hour south of Tokyo on the Shinkansen, on the bullet train.
Wow.
Which was amazing, mate. Dude, genuinely, 3 years there. And Australian culture, like we just spoke about before, Australian culture and Japanese culture couldn't be further apart. Like, and the place that I was going into, it was very rural.
Mm.
You look out your window, all you see is green tea farms. Like, genuinely, it was very rural, and it forced you to live the real Japanese lifestyle, which was unreal, mate. Like, I remember the first day, though, that I was there. I've told this story before. I was in Australia, when it's hot, no one wears shoes. We go to the shops bare feet, you know,
right.
In Australia. And in Japan, that's a big no-no. Like, everything has to be proper in Japan.
Mm.
I went down to the 7-Eleven bare feet and the ladies went crazy. Obviously, I didn't speak Japanese, but they were just coming up to me pointing at my feet. And I was like, what's going on here?
Yeah.
Like, I was freaked out. So it was a massive culture shock going over there. And then it's like vice versa. It's like in Japan, you're supposed to bow to, like, when you, even in the shopping center, if you get in someone's way, you just bow to them and like and walk around them type thing.
Business cards as well. You hand the business card over to hand.
And you bow. But the problem was, after my first couple of years there, I was going back to Australia, going back to Frankston, and I was going through the shopping center.
Yeah.
And I was bowing to people and they're looking at me like, what do you want? You know what I mean? Like, they think I want to fight.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because I'm going like that to them, like that. And it was just that. It just shows you the massive culture shock of, but it was so good, mate. Like, I loved it. I genuinely loved my time at Yamaha. And then 3 years got up there and I was kind of deciding whether to stay at Yamaha, go back to Australia and try and play for the Wallabies or, then I got the bell from Gregor to come over to Scotland and, for whatever reason, I don't know why, I just had a gut feeling that Scotland was the place for me and I chose Scotland. And looking back now, it's 4 years ago, it's worked out really well, mate. And I'm so glad to be over here. I feel like I'm in the right place.
Yeah.
You know?
Would you call it home?
It's home now. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Because it's where my son's born, you know? Like I said, I've re-signed here for another 3 years. So I'm going to be here for the next, you know, I would have been here for 7 to 8 years, you know? So So yeah, it's home now for me, and I can't really see myself being anywhere else but Scotland at the moment, you know?
Do you think Japan, in a way, was a good, like, because I can feel the energy off of you. You seem like the kind of person that needs, like, a real good workout in order to go to sleep. Do you know what I mean? Like, you need to, like, sprint for miles in order to, like almost sit and watch a movie. Would you be able to do that, or would you be, like...
What, do you mean like I need to buzz out? That's what the missus is good for, brother. You have a nice cuddle with the missus before bed and then you're good to go.
But it seems like from the energy I get from you, it's like you've got so much energy.
Yeah, I am a high energy person. Like I have never been diagnosed, but my partner always tells me I have severe ADHD. Like I've never been diagnosed or anything. Whether or not I believe that, I don't know. But I'm high energy. I know that.
Yeah. But no, that's a great thing. But like I think that... In those formative years, like, were you in Japan? I'm going to say you were 23 to 26 or something.
I actually went to Japan at 21, turning 22.
Right. Yeah. But do you not think that's a good... Because in 21 to 24, everybody that I knew, myself included, was a little bit fucking crazy. Like, they went out every weekend, did whatever they did. But if you're in Japan, and especially people that are high energy like that, like, it's the drink, you know, whatever else they're doing... But if you're in Japan, if you're surrounded by tea leaves and it's like very cultural and it's calm, do you think that helps your kind of grounding?
Yeah, you think it's like Zen.
Yeah.
Zen.
Yeah.
I don't know because I did a lot of drinking over in Japan, to be honest, mate. I won't lie to you. It is just more, for me anyways, I never moved away from my home city in my career. So moving away from Melbourne was the best thing that I could have ever done. Whether it was where... I was going anywhere, you know?
Yeah.
I think just moving out of my home city, moving out of, you know, being around my parents and my cousins and all that type of stuff, being removed from that environment, I had to probably become more dependent on myself, you know? And that was the main thing. And then also you add to the isolated environment that you are when you're in Japan, the culture, the language barrier, you know? But you mostly, it's very isolated place, you know, in Shizuoka. So, I think just the friendships that I built over there, I had and this goes back to, you know, being a family man. My cousin played for Yamaha at the time.
Yeah.
And he had, I think he's got four kids now, but at the time he had two.
He's
and
he lived popping them over.
He's been on hard. He just lived across the road from me. And I got to see like a more simple life, if you know what I mean? Like what made him tick. And we had our fellowship as well over in Japan where, you know, all the foreigners would come over and it wasn't so much that we would read from the Bible, but we would more talk about what anyone's struggling with and be each other's support network over in Japan. And
that's nice.
He would lead that. And yeah, I don't know. I just watched how he operated with his family and what made him happy. You know, like he would go home and play on his PlayStation and be around his kids and... That was his happiness, you know?
Yeah, and that was his endorphin
exactly.
rush almost.
And as young athletes, maybe we chase that in so many other places, you know? But there's a time and place for all of that, you know? And I think it's good for the young boys to go get that out of their system. But I was kind of already nearing the point where I was being influenced by my cousin and seeing what he made him tick. And I was inspired a little bit, to be honest, with how he was with his family, you know, and his faith and everything and what made him tick. And he didn't need the applause from everyone else. You know what I mean? Like he was so secure with who he was and his family and, you know, the role that he had to play in order to provide for his family and help raise his kids and everything that, like that. I was just truly pretty inspired by that. And
is that where the faith came into it?
To be honest, probably, yeah. Like my dad always raised us, I wouldn't say religious. Like I don't want to lie and say we weren't raised very religious, but always very faithful. And he always implemented like the role of God in your life and everything like that. But to be honest, I was never really that close with that side, if you know what I mean. Like I would pray before games, but looking back at it back then, I was praying for success rather than saying thank you.
It makes sense.
You know, being around my cousin, I got to see, you know, the real power of faith and not having to seek applause or gratification from anyone else other than God, you know? And that had massive influence on me, genuinely. And I would say my career turned the corner when I left Japan off the back of that, you know?
Wow.
Genuinely off the back of that, because I started finding myself of what I was as a kid, you know, to get me to that point. You know, I was disciplined, I worked hard, and I found all those things in myself again to get me back to, and I would say that's probably what the last 4 years have looked like for me, is turning back into what I was before all of that happened, you know?
Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah.
Okay, and then so Scotland comes around. This podcast is brought to you by Chisholm Hunter, the best place to get your luxury watches or luxury jewellery. Chisholm Hunter are family run, and they've been family run since 1857. That's over 165 years. Yes, you heard me right, 165 years, which is pretty insane. They have 29 stores throughout the UK, which is also wild considering that most companies nowadays are owned by big conglomerates. And in my opinion, when a big conglomerate owns a company, it kind of loses its personality. It loses so much of what made it so special in the first place. And that's why I personally shop at Chisholm Hunter for my luxury watches. Now, they're official retailers for a bunch of different brands: Tag Heuer, Omega, Tudor, Vacheron Constantin, Breguet, Blancpain, etc., etc., etc. Pretty much every brand you can think of, they're official authorized retailers of them. And also, they're world renowned for their luxury diamonds and luxury jewelry. So if you're looking for something for yourself or a loved one, then head to chismhunter.co.uk. That's chismhunter.co.uk. And while you're on the Chisholm Hunter website, use the discount code CHSUB, that is CHSUB, for an exclusive 10% off selected lines, courtesy of the Into the Mind podcast. Thank you guys so much for listening to this episode and supporting Chisholm Hunter. And let's get back to this conversation with Sione. And also give him a watch, because I feel like that naked wrist is just, it's annoying me. And then I heard you were stuck in a hotel for 4 weeks.
Oh yeah, mate, that was crazy. Isolation, bro. So I came over, did 2 weeks of isolation. Oh, there's there's windows, but they don't open in this hotel.
Oh my God.
And it's pouring rain, bro.
Yeah.
Like,
that'll be a reality shock for you as well.
Well, I'm looking out the windows and I'm going, something's wrong here. Like, I've made a bad decision here. So yeah. I pop out after that first 2 weeks, so relieved. The very first day we start training, there's a case, a COVID case.
Oh my God.
I have to go back in and isolate for another two.
Jesus,
so it's proper Christ. Shutter Island in this hotel. It felt like I was doing time. You
did
know
you just
mean?
Have like a PlayStation and a TV?
I had no PlayStation, bro. It was tough times. I won't be able to say on this podcast what I was getting up to with that. You know what I mean? But it was lonely, lonely times. Yeah. Oh, geez, I was so happy when I got out of it. And then when we popped out of it, I got to meet all the lads because it was the end of the season. I got to have a couple beers and introduce myself and... And then, so it was a rough start, but once I got out and I got to know all the lads, man, I already felt like it was the right place to be.
It was worth it.
Yeah.
It was worth the pain. And who's the closest, like, who's your closest pal on the rugby team?
I would say at Glasgow, they call us the Antipodeans. I never was aware of that word until Pete Murchie came up to me. We're all the Aussies and Kiwis were around each other. Pete Murchie came up to us one today and was like, the Antipodeans. And I had to go home and put it in Google what that was. Most of the Aussies and Kiwis, we do hang out with each other a lot, like guys like Tom Jordan, Josh Mackay, Jack Dempsey, Sam Talakai now, Sione Vailanu, who's at the club. They're my closest mates. I'm also like real close with a lot of the Kyle Stain, George Horn, those lads that I've played with now for the last 4 years, I'm real close with. And I think when you go into the Scotland environment, it's good because you hang out with the Glasgow boys all year and you get to freshen up a little bit when you go, because you get to get to Scotland, because you get to hang out with, you know, Finn, who's at Bath, or Dewey, and my brother who's at Edinburgh. So most of the lads I'm real close with, to be honest.
Yeah. I saw a really sort of heartwarming video of you and your gran.
Yeah.
How did that come about? Because she came to surprise you from Australia, right?
Yeah, it was unreal, bro. To be honest, bro, the reason why it was so shocking for me is because every campaign comes across and I ask my mum if I can get my gran here, you know? And she's like, it's not possible. Like, she wouldn't be able to handle it on, you know, a flight over. And
long flight as well.
Long flight. Yeah. And I was just like, yeah, fair enough. So I gave up on that, you know? Yeah. Like, I was just like, it's not going to happen. So when I walked into that room and I saw her, bro, like, and also for me as well, I'd been away from the 3 years in Japan and also the 4 years here, that's 7 years away from home. She looked exactly the same to me. And like, that's what made it so like nostalgic almost, is that it felt like I was a kid walking into my grandma's house before, you know? And when I saw her, she just looked how I looked. She looked when I was a kid, you know, 7 years ago. So it was such a special time. And for her to, I suppose at that age, and I don't want to offend people that are a little bit older, but life becomes a little bit less interesting than what you were when you were 18, 19, 20.
Yeah, you can't do as much.
Yeah, you can't do as much, you know. You're not as active. But to have such a big moment in her life at that age, I was just so stoked for her, you know. And I'd watch her, you know, go through her hardships in her life, and to see her have that such a crowning moment, like she handed over the cup to me, you know, and that's usually what Princess Anne does.
Yeah.
So like I just to more so for her than me, I was so happy for her to have that moment, you know, and she loved it. She loved the attention and she loved being the greenie granny, and she'd walk around and get noticed. It was so hilarious. I was stoked for her, man.
Yeah. And what's your, like, the relationship with your parents like? Has always been pretty good? Have they come over here as well, or are they still?
Mate, I had a dream childhood, and I've always been real close with my mum and dad. My mum and dad have both been over, but to be honest, every time my dad comes over, I get hurt. He was over here the whole Six Nations. And he was here the last Six Nations as well.
That would have been good though if you were in a shit place mentally.
Yeah, exactly. He was massive for it, man. He got to spend time with my son and everything like that, and he got to bond. My son's actually named after him. He got to bond with my son and everything. So, that was the silver lining for me is that he got to spend time with my son during that period, and we all got to spend time together and bond. And those are the moments you never get back. So, it was good, man.
Yeah. And the captainship, so you're the captain of the Scotland rugby team. What does it take to be a captain, do you think?
Oh, geez, man, that's a big question.
Typical podcast question.
I think what I've learned anyway about being, or like leadership in general, there's so many ways to skin the cat, you know, like not all leaders are the same, but there's plenty of effective ways to be a leader, you know? And I think for me anyways, it was at first just owning the fact that you have influence. Like I remember ever since I was a kid, when I was getting in trouble at school, you know, I'd be in the principal's office or be in, you know, getting in trouble, and I'd be getting screamed at by teachers and then always be like, you don't understand, but these kids follow you.
Yeah.
And I would never understand what, and I'd be like, oh, I didn't ask them to, you know what I mean? That would always be my reaction because I probably didn't own the fact that people maybe want to follow me and stuff like that. And I think the first part of leadership is owning the fact that you do, people want to follow you, you know? Mm. And that was a big part for me because I never really looked at, like I always felt that I did have pull, but I never really wanted the title, you know, and then when you own it and everything like that, you accept that your leadership is why you're in that role. They've put you in there for a reason and owning that, you know? And for me anyways, I think my style of leadership is high energy. Like you've already assessed about me, you know, I want to lead by action and be high energy and be a motivator for my teammates. And, I think that those are two things that sticks out to me anyways, of all the other leaders that I've, you know, kind of looked at, is that there's plenty of ways to skin the cat. And, I think the most important thing is accepting your style of leadership, you know?
I can feel that off you. I can feel the motivation. I can also, so there's alpha males, beta, and then have you heard of sigma male?
No.
So actually ADHD plays a big part in it.
Yeah.
Or neurodivergency plays a big part in it actually. So sigma males are essentially people that like don't care. They do their own thing.
Right.
So they go their own way. And in doing that, people tend to follow. Because they're kind of doing stuff that's so left field that people find it interesting. So they just kind of come to see.
Yeah.
But typically speaking, neurodiverse people do that a lot because they can't help it.
They're just going with the flow type thing.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what's funny is actually me and Demo, this is ages ago, Jack Dempsey, we're real close.
Yeah.
And Jack holds himself to the alpha male standard. You know what I mean? And he assesses people on their alpha male standards, you know what I mean? And I remember we were having a beer and I was just like, we're pretty close now, bro, you know, me and you. And I'll just tell, you know, we do actually have very similar personalities, me and you. He goes, yeah, you really surprised me when I first met you. And I was like, why is that?
Mm.
And he was like, because you're an alpha male in a beta body. And I was like, I don't even know if that's a compliment, bro. Obviously, because he's a 6'5", a massive dude.
Yeah.
And I'm not as big as him. And it was his way of telling me, yeah, you're an alpha male, but you're not as alpha as me. You know
what I mean? You're not quite there yet.
Yeah, you talking about alpha and betas have just made me remember about that.
Who do you think is the most alpha male rugby player out at the moment?
Well, we've had this conversation recently. My honest answer, the most alpha male rugby player I've ever been around, geez. Demo would be up there, but I think it's also because he's also a very peculiar man. You know what I mean?
Like, well, like very detailed.
Like, well, no, there's mystery around Demo, you know what I mean? Because he doesn't speak to anyone. he comes into training and some days he'll say two words for the whole day. And that adds to his mystery, you know what I mean? But I play with Amanaki Mafia. You won't know him. He's a Tongan fella. He also in Japan. I won't get into it, like the yarns and stuff about him, but he's the biggest alpha I've ever played with, definitely.
Yeah. What a scary motherfucker.
It's not that he's scary. He just couldn't turn down a fade. Like if it was presented to him, if something was presented to him in terms of
a challenge. Yeah,
there is no way he could turn it down. You know what I mean? And that's just to me what an alpha male is. He'd probably be the biggest alpha male that I've ever played with.
Who do you think's the inspiration? Because you've got all these guys that are like the alpha males, and then you've got the old style, like John Barkley, perfect like alpha male back in the day. But he was also a great captain.
Mm.
Who do you think your
inspirational figure
was growing up?
It's a good question. This is going to be kind of weird, but this is where our motivation came from, me and my brothers. Me and my brothers, when we were younger, we used to watch all the All Accesses for Floyd Mayweather. And so basically, they still do them now, but they're not as good. Showtime used to do this thing where they used to follow the boxer 24/7. And they used to follow him for the 7 days leading up to the fight. And Floyd's so outspoken. And which is why we gravitated to Floyd. You know, we loved, so anytime we would watch the tapes over and over again, like when he fought Mosley or when he fought De La Hoya or when he fought Maidana. And there's this 3-episode series, but the way he would speak about his craft or like the thing that he was good at was so inspirational to us, you know, like how dedicated he was to his sport. And you know, you're speaking about the Conor McGregor thing.
There's
a famous saying in boxing is that it's hard to go run the miles when you wake up in silk sheets.
Oh, that's exactly it.
And that's what made Floyd so different for us anyways, when we were, is that for some reason mentally, he never lost the drive. Like he was most paid athlete for,
it was like 5 years or something.
Years
like that.
On years. Yeah. So top of the Forbes list, right? Yeah. Most paid athlete. He's making more money than anyone. He was undefeated. No one could beat him, but he never lost his, and all the yarns that would come up out about him about how he would run home from nightclubs because he doesn't drink or smoke. He would run home from nightclubs in his jeans, just get miles in. You know what I mean?
The chief that you must have called would be terrible.
Ching about it, bro. And like his weird working out hours, you know, like he would go work out. And there's a lot of bad things that Floyd did as well that I'm not saying I condone.
He's not perfect.
He's not perfect. But the one thing that he never, ever compromised was the work.
He's disciplined. You know?
He's so disciplined. Mm. And like to do that, like if you really look at Floyd's career, he has fought 50 times. 51 times if you count, you know,
McGregor,
a couple of the last ones that were questionable. Every time you step into the ring, you risk getting knocked out by one punch. That punch has never landed on Floyd Mayweather. He's never been to the canvas. So like the amount of discipline that needs to be shown, you know what I mean? He's beaten more world champions than anyone. The amount of discipline, and not only that, but like the consistency of it, you know what I mean? To keep stacking up, I'm 42-0, I'm not losing my discipline. Oh, I own like all these houses and all these fancy cars, I won't skip the work, you know? And you can't really look back in history as an athlete that's done that, you know?
Yeah,
maybe LeBron James now is a good one, but you know, even your Michael Jordans and stuff like that, they all had times in their career where
they were down.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, where
Floyd was never down, you know, and he never, it's mind boggling. And I remember it was so inspirational to us. We would watch, and he has the background of coming from Michigan and his dad was a boxer, his uncle were a boxer, both of them went to jail and he had to really fight, you know, for his where he is now. And that was so inspirational to us. So it's not necessarily a rugby player that was the foundation of our inspiration. I would say it was probably just another athlete from another sport that sparked that interest in us.
He was so smart though in what he did, because he knew if people hated him, they'd watch him.
Exactly.
So like he knew.
And his quotes, bro. I just love his quote. I saw the one the other day, popped up again. It was like, do you just fight for money? And then, no, he was like, why do you just fight for money? And he was like, why not? He was like, then he's like, I'm a prize fighter. You know, that's what I'm supposed to be fighting for. And he's like, I think his ending quote was like, money don't make me, I make money. And it was just like, yes, Floyd. You know what I mean? It's just entertaining. Like and in rugby, there's not really a personality like that, because obviously individual sport and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And he's so outlandish and everything. But he was so smart with, he didn't care he adopted the villain role.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And that's hard not to let that get to you.
Oh, well, do
every stadium you go to, there's 60,000 people hovering to see you lose.
Yeah. Yeah. But do you read the comments?
On
Instagram? So say you're
playing. Yeah, I have before, no doubt.
Do you get impacted by that?
I would say, that's a hard question. I would say for me, I don't, because sometimes I laugh at things people say, because they're not inside the building, but maybe subconsciously you'd have to admit as an athlete, something's got to you. You know what I mean? Like you've had a bad game and people are riding you or whatever, or something's happened in the game that people aren't happy about. But I think that comes back to having that foundation of being a family man, is that and a man of faith, is that I'm not judged by people I don't know, you know? I'm judged by God and my family, you know?
Yeah, and you're not looking for external validation.
I don't need your gratification,
Yeah, that's quite a good thing, because I find that a lot of people that are driven in the wrong way, they're just driven towards money and they don't have that support group, they need external validation.
Yeah, exactly.
So because they can't get it elsewhere. So they do read the comments, and then at one point, everyone will love you one game, and then you by accident drop a ball, and everyone's going to fucking hate you the next game. That can be dangerous for people.
Yeah, 100%, mate. That's one of the most dangerous things in sport. And now with social media, is that everyone's got a voice.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? A guy sitting on at home, 60 years old, eating a bag of potato chips can tell you that you're not playing well, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's the part where you have to be bulletproof in terms of that.
Mm.
And I think part of it as well is not reading when they're saying you're going well.
Yeah.
You know, because quite often, what they say about you is when you're going well, you know, when they say you're going well, you're probably not going that well.
Yeah.
When you say you're going bad, you're probably not going that bad.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it's just I think part of the reason as well, not taking the hype of when you're playing well, in the same way as if you're not playing well, to not read into that. But I think that's a big part of it, is you got to be on that flip side as well. Because if you're getting all of that validation when you're playing well, when you're not playing well, you're peaking.
See if
those people have changed up, you know what I mean? That's the psyche of an athlete, you know?
Yeah.
So I think it's most important that you don't believe your hype, you know, or the good things people are saying about you.
Do the boys, I know that because this Six Nations, you obviously didn't play because of the injury, but do any of the boys, you don't need to say specifics, obviously, but as a captain, do you kind of warn them away from that?
I don't think you can ever tell another grown man not to do social media. You know what I mean?
Stay off your phone today, by the way.
Stay off your phone, bro. They'd be like, what? It's all up to them. Now, look, rugby's developing now where there's mental skills coaches and stuff like that all within the environment, you know?
Yeah.
And sometimes players get the help with that type of stuff, you know? They get help from the mental skills coaches not to be able to get affected by those things, you know?
Mm.
That's a skill. It's a very big part of skill of rugby now, is that once you get a professional, 80% of the players, you're all on the same level.
Mm.
It's the next
20%
when you get elite is the mental strength, I feel like, you know?
And
even when you get to test rugby, I feel like everyone's the same talent, you know? And then the ones that are really, really good at test rugby are the ones with the top 2 inches. That's what I think anyways.
Yeah. And do you think in this year, in the Six Nations, I mean, it was so... See, as a fan watching Scotland, there were so many times, like, 1 point against France.
Yeah.
Against England. The point in the France game where Darcy and Finn bumped heads.
Yeah.
Doohan was a naughty boy, got sent off. And yeah. I was like, why is this happening?
Yeah.
What was the... Talk me through the chat in the changing room after, or, like, halfway through and after the game.
Well, I wasn't there.
Do you not get involved at all when you're injured?
When I was hurt, I was only going in for the Monday, Tuesday leadership meetings, being around the group, but I'm not going into the game,
right.
Going to the change rooms after to see the coaches react and stuff like that. But I wouldn't be able to tell you for sure, but I've been in games where things are tight, and rugby now, like the top level rugby, the margins are so small and
tiny.
Like, I see, it's hard not to become protective of, you know, your coach and stuff like that, but the amount of criticism coaches get for maybe not getting your team over the line. And I to be honest, I kind of learned that, you know, I think it was 2-3 years ago, the coach that brought me over, Danny Wilson, got sacked from Glasgow. And in hindsight, you know, like, all he took all the blame, you know, for what happened at Glasgow. We weren't going well and he took all the blame, you know, and...
It's a pretty tough position to be in.
In hindsight, bro, it wasn't that, you know, like, it wasn't all his fault. And I think about my professionalism during the time that he was there. I think about the professionalism of other players. Oh, I know he, like, coaches have influence over the environment, stuff like that. But to say that it was all one man fault, like, I don't believe that's true, you know. And as players, we have to take some of that responsibility, you know? Same way when you win, it's not all because of a coach. It's a collective environment, you know? And obviously Franco's come over and done an amazing job, one of the best coaches that I've ever had, you know? And but you need the players to be on the same page as the coach, and you need to be workers. That relationship needs to work in tandem, you know? Because, and that's what I just find harsh about, you know, Test rugby now, is that there's such small margins and people don't see the work going on behind the scenes, you know, of us to even be in that game, you know, or lose by 1 point. People don't understand how much work's even going on with the coaches and the playing group to even be in that game in the first place, at England, for example. And I don't know, maybe, and Finn misses a kick, he's hit 100 times at the end, which could have happened to anyone. And, you know, coaches get the blame, players get the blame, but the margins are so small, you know, and, to build a successful environment, it's not just one thing, you know. And not quite often, I feel like at the moment anyways, the coach gets the blame and stuff like that. And yeah, I can't help but feel like that's not the case, you know.
No, it's a combination of factors, you know. You can never blame the... there was a fight that happened recently in the UFC. It was a Paddy Pimblett versus... did you see that?
I saw that fight, yeah.
So, was it Chandler?
So
Chandler's coach was being like, what are you doing? We've talked about this 100 times. Like, why are you doing something different to what we practice?
Yeah.
And he just wouldn't follow the coach's instruction.
There was no response,
but the coach got the blame.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, it wasn't really... The coach has done everything he can. Yeah. It's up to the athletes at the end of the day to bring that together.
Exactly.
Like, they are the glue that sticks it all together.
Yeah.
What was your reaction like in... I know everybody talks about the Scotland England game. It's the classic one that everyone's for whatever reason, there's just this thing between Scotland and England.
Massive, eh?
There just is. What was your reaction when it was 1 point we lost by?
To be honest, so when Stafford made the break on the set piece move, and then we scored directly after with Dewey, I was in the crowd. I was at Twickenham.
Yeah.
But I'd walk down because we were on the verge of losing and I didn't want to get stuck in all the crazy England fans going crazy. Then when we scored, I'd run back up and I was like, yeah, we got him. We got him, you know what I mean? And I was so stoked that I was just like, I can't believe we've nipped him again.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then obviously Finn misses the kick and the energy just goes from there to here.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I was like, no way. But in some ways, like, I know this was a big message in the group. That was one of our better games, you know, over the
100%.
Last couple of years. The way we're attacking, the way, you know, our backs were getting involved and everything like that. Like, that was one of our better games. So
not only that, England were also playing really well.
Exactly.
It's almost as if the vendetta raises both.
And that's what I mean about small margins, mate. Like, to take it this way, like, I've watched Finn hit that kick at training 1 million times.
Mm.
I've watched him in games hit it 1 million times. It's just like, for a one-off time, a one-off skill execution, he missed.
Mm.
You know, and that's why small the margins are in Test rugby. And ultimately there's so many things off the back of that that come, you know, you get start getting criticized, your coach gets criticized, your playing group gets criticized, and that's all stuff you have to welcome because you didn't get the job done. We understand that, but it's important for those boys not to overreact, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. Not think too much into it.
Yeah, because when you start looking for things that aren't there, you know what I mean?
Like,
why did we lose that game? Why we missed the kick at the end. Maybe we didn't finish the couple of opportunities in the first half. But don't go digging for things that aren't there, you know?
Yeah. I just felt like in this Six Nations, and I know that I say this every time, and there's literally like quotes of me on this podcast saying exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
But I do think we got pretty unlucky. Like, and I know that you're not going to like to hear that because as the captain, you're going to be like, well, I think we didn't work hard enough. We could have done better here. But for example, the France game, Finn colliding with Darcy.
Yeah, and they pick it up and score.
Yeah, and so they both go off. And then also you have
Doohan. Oh, do you mean that was the Ireland game? That was the Ireland game.
Or Ireland game, they both go off. And then Darcy's a naughty boy Doohan's a naughty boy having
that's
a scrap.
The Ireland game, yeah.
And I was like, three very good players for Scotland all get sent off more or less at the same time.
Yeah.
I was like, and also we didn't actually lose by that much considering we'd lost three great boys.
Yeah.
I was kind of like,
yeah. Oh, to be honest, I don't share that opinion. Like I don't share that feeling. Because Ireland's been a thing that we haven't been able to get over the hump now for a couple of years. And I don't think our excuse is that Finn got knocked out or Dewey getting a yellow card.
Yeah.
An action. That's not an unlucky thing, you know? And Dewey will tell you that, you know, that's an action of him doing something bad and then he gets sent off, you know? These are all things I think you got to own, you know? And I don't think that's a good example of us being unlucky, to be honest. I think in the Ireland game, we were outplayed a little bit. The boys will probably be the first to admit that, you know? And, but I think in other games, like for example, the England game the year before when we played France, and the ref called it no try on full time when we could see it on the line. Those things are hard to take. I get it, but you know, I think one thing that I've noticed as well, I don't think we should develop like a defeatist mentality. If you know what I mean, where we always feel so hard done by that we didn't get there. Do you know what I mean? Like that. That's like, in my opinion, a little bit weak. You know what I mean? Like we start looking for things of how unlucky we were rather than things that we could have controlled to win, you know? And it's always the thing of like, if you kind of look at all professional sports, like for example, the Chiefs at the moment in the NFL, everyone complains about how biased the refs are for the Chiefs. You know what I mean? Because they've been the best team in the NFL for the past 4 or 5 years. That happens in every sport, you know? Like the successful team get the biased call, like whatever, you know, you get the 50-50 calls or whatever. That happens in every sport. But at some point, that best team took it off someone else.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? They took off what do they call it? They call it a winning privilege off someone else. Do you know what I mean? Like the good team privilege off someone else. So ultimately, we have to try and take that off. You know what I mean? Like we always feel like they were so hard done by the refs and all of that. But to become the team that gets maybe the 50-50 calls because you're the better team.
Yeah.
You have to take it, you know what I mean, off someone. Which is ultimately like what the good teams have done to be able to, you know, those teams haven't been the best teams the past 30 years.
Yeah.
But they've taken that privilege off another team. And that happens in every sport, you know? Yeah. We can't think of that our cop-out, you know, that we get hard done by the refs. So I've never really thought like that or shared that. And it's hard to take that, it's hard to swallow that pill because I'm involved in these games against France where I can see the ball on the line and they don't give it. Then it becomes hard because you're so invested on the field. You've given so much yourself that I found myself blaming the ref after that game. You know, I found myself going in my room going, we will run that game with that ref, you know?
Yeah.
But if you really look back on the game, there were things that you could have controlled way before that.
Exactly.
You know?
But everyone hops onto that one thing because it's such a pivotal moment. But I remember that ball went down.
Oh, man, I was right next to it. I told the ref, you see it? I was like, it's there. You know what I mean? Like, I was right there. I could see the ball and I felt it so good here, you know? But we didn't get the try.
Yeah.
You know? It hurt. It hurt real bad because...
Did you talk to the ref after that?
To be honest, I remember feeling, I was on the far touchline because at the time I wasn't captain. Finn was captain.
Right. Okay.
And
okay.
And I was just, I could feel them about to not award this. Like I could just feel it, you know, like, and I was like, they're not going to give it. They were looking at it for so long. And usually when they look at something for so long, they don't give it.
Yeah.
So I just felt, and I was on the touchline. And as soon as I saw it go up, no try, I just walked straight to the bench. Yeah. The game was over anyway. I just couldn't believe it. But yeah, like I said, that wasn't the one reason why we lost, you know. There was plenty of other times in that game, you really look back and break it down, that we could have done better in and won the game. And I think that's an important mentality to have in top level sport.
Yeah. You know what's been an incredible thing to see recently is you and Hugh Jones. It has been unreal. Like seeing all your like tries from Glasgow and actually like seeing the stuff you practice come into effect. Like there's something that you guys always do, which is like you'll grubber it and he'll manage to sneak around and score the try. You've done it like three times now.
Yeah.
And you guys are such a good double act. Are you close?
Yeah, we're very close off the field.
Yeah.
I would say it's a weird one because I always get into Shug because he went to Millfield, you know, Millfield, the big school in England, real posh school.
Is that where his accent's from?
Yeah. So,
right.
And they wore suits to school and everything. And, and his personality is very sarcastic if you've met Shuggy. Like, I would say in that way, we're like real different, but I think we get along so well because we egg each other on, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
His sarcasm, and then I get angry at his sarcasm and go personal, you know what I mean? And I think that's probably why we get along, is because we're very different in a lot of ways. And but on the rugby field, we mesh, and we've meshed so well from the minute we play, which is the thing that you have to be grateful for, is that from the first time we played together to now, our combination is so fluid.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
I think naturally, and all the things that we fine tune on the training field are the cherry on top, you know? Yeah. But I really feel like from the very first time we started playing together, it all just went like that, you know?
Yeah.
And that comes down to like play styles, meshing, you know, and things like that. But yeah, I love playing with Shuggy. He brings the best out of my game, and I like to think that I bring the best out in his, you know?
Is that like a healthy competition? Like, are you guys almost...
We're very competitive with each other.
Yeah, but that's good, because that will bring out the best in both of you, right?
Yeah, very competitive. He has this... Like, take it this way, man. I beat him at everything. but he has this one thing over me, right? After we won the final over Pretoria, we're doing the court session after. And have you ever heard of a goanna wrestle?
No.
So you tie two belts together, right? And you put your necks in it like that, and you get on your hands and knees like that, and you pull away from each other like a goanna.
To strengthen your neck.
Well, it's to see whose neck's the strongest, right? And in my career, I've never seen someone of Tongan heritage lose this battle.
Okay.
You know what I mean? So I'm talking shit before we go. I was like, this private school boy's not gonna do anything with me. I was talking that game as well.
Yeah.
And just a little side note, I do have a case of neuropraxia, which is nerve damage in my shoulder, which heavily influenced this battle. Like, I won't make excuses because it's what we've just been speaking about. Yeah. I won't make excuses. But anyways, we get into this goanna wrestle and I start feeling a weird abnormal bit of strength from Shug. And I'm just like, what's going on here? And I'm trying to play it off. I was like, wait, 1 minute, something. Yeah. Like, this guy's actually strong. Anyways, he beats me at the goanna wrestle. And the next 3 days are hell on earth. And like, he's watching me in the gym for the next, you know, couple of weeks. When we're thing. He's like, yeah, bro, strengthen that neck up. Like walking past me, it's hurting, you know, it's really hurting. Like I felt like I let my heritage down, you know? Like,
yeah.
Because I've never seen a Tongan lose this type of battle. We're supposed to have the strongest necks in the game, you know?
Well, you look at the Tongans and they are like, it's the traps and the neck is like.
Yeah, thick necks, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, there's questionable things. I'm not going to say that he was on performance enhancing or anything like that, but there's a few questionable things that I don't know where that strength come from that day. Or it could be that I just played in the grand final and I gave it everything. Maybe Shug was reserving energy in that grand final, but we're very competitive against each other. Literally everything that we do, we try and be better at each other at, but that is what makes us a good combo, I think. We're competitors first, you know? Yeah. And
did you ever take, before you do weights, do you ever do smelling salts?
I've never done smelling salts, no.
Do you want to try them?
If you got one here? You sure these are Asada past here? We're not doing...
So They're strong smelling. So they're not illegal.
This better not get funky in here, bro. Like, no. Jeffrey Dahmer about to drug me on your podcast.
No. Jamie Batty's taking them. Miss Scotland.
All right, Jamie Batty taking them is not going to make me take them.
Miss Scotland. They are quite strong.
Like, just have a little whiff. But, so what's it going to do? Make me...
Oh, you just, like, react. You okay, just yeah, like that.
Chuck it over.
Nothing bad.
Yeah.
I'm just riffing. No, I'm just kidding. So...
You do it first, bro.
I'll do it if you want me to do it. Miss Scotland took him. Like, you have to... So Miss Scotland took him. So it's like, you'll be fine.
So just put it to my thing?
But, like, be careful because it will, like...
Bro.
That's not nice.
Wow. What does that do to you?
Wrestlers, weightlifters take them before they lift. It, like, adrenaline
I'm
buzzes
I'm getting
you.
Dizzy, bro. I'm fading.
The camera's shut off.
Yeah. Room starts getting dark.
Yeah. Wait, I need to try them now that you've done. So yeah, miss.
So what, do you do that before? And what does it make it more alert?
Oh my God. Yeah. Oh my God, yeah. So basically, they're really strong, these ones, to be fair. Oh, you should watch the Jamie Batty one because even he was like crying after them. But so essentially before you lift like super heavy weights, you'll see like the massive guys, they'll go and sniff it, adrenaline kicks in, then they lift the weight.
Yeah, right.
But that's how you get Hugh. See the next time
before
you do
the guano wrestle, you reckon?
Yeah, yeah.
Nah, I've been training all year, my neck, mate. You don't understand, I'm getting an extra. I'm at home, bro, doing the Mike Tyson rollout. It's all my man. And if I get injured in rugby from it, so be it. I need to win the next goanna wrestle. You know what I mean?
I was going to say, so I asked a load of people on Instagram if they have any questions
for
you.
Oh, nice, yeah.
So do you want me to...
Yeah, get through them.
Yeah, let's
hopefully
get
no
through them.
No one stitched me up.
So there's nothing, but if there's anything bad, I will...
All good.
I'll go over it. So what are your thoughts on the nickname, the Scottish Rhino?
Boy, is that my nickname? Is it?
That's your nickname.
Oh, I'll take that one. I've actually done these random. Last time I was in South Africa, we did a safari. Oh, when I went with the Rebels,
yeah.
We got to dart a rhino, and like,
did you?
Yeah, to look after it. You know what I mean? Like, into.
Oh, right, like to move it.
Yeah,
like
yeah, exactly.
It.
But
yeah,
when okay. they, so they just become woozy.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe how big this thing was, man. Like I was walking it. It was to protect it. You know what I mean? Because you know they get hunted for their horns and everything. So I'll take that. I've seen up close what the rhino is capable of. Yeah. I'll take that.
Yeah. I think it's pretty good though. Because I was looking at a typical before this. I was on like, I was meant to be working and I was on TikTok. And because I'd searched your name, tons of you started coming up.
Right.
And it was something like the Scottish rhino takes three guys. And it was like you going in between three guys.
I thought maybe it was because my big schnoz that's the rhino horn.
Mate, I've got a big schnoz. Right. Who is your, okay, I'll change this slightly because the question's been asked slightly.
Yeah.
Who is your inspiration on the Scotland team?
Wow. Okay. Inspiration on the Scotland team. Wow, it's a really good question. You know, I'll do an honest one.
None of them.
And it's not that he's an inspiration to me, but I wouldn't say proud. Proud's not the right word. He won't like me using proud because that makes him lower than me. I'm proud of you, Junior. But I'll say Blair, genuinely. Because, you know, when I first moved to Scotland, Blair was at Edinburgh and they were trialing him out at number 10 and stuff like that. And he was going through ups and downs as a number 10. And that was when I first got my first viewing of how harsh the public can really be.
Yeah.
You know, and I remember we played Australia and he missed the kick to win it or whatever. And the some of the things people were saying about him, you know,
backlash.
And I couldn't believe it. Like genuinely, I just couldn't believe. And to see him come out the other side, go to Toulouse, achieve everything that he's achieved, be one of the best fullbacks now in the world, best back three. Mm-hmm. He won't like that I say back three because he's not a winger apparently. But yeah, to be one of the best in his position in the world now, to be on the other side, I think more I'm just like, you got to be strong mentally to come out the other side of that, you know? And he has. And it's not, I'm not saying I'm proud of him, but I'm just saying like, it is pretty cool to see like one of your good mates, you know, go on that path of maybe being one of the most highly criticized athletes in Scotland to then go on to Toulouse. And you watch a lot of those guys turn corner and start talking good about him. You know? And I think it shows how secure in himself and his own talent he is. And
yeah,
I think that, and we, after just talking about the social media stuff before, yeah. I think that's a really good one to say. Is that Blair? Like, it's awesome to see his journey now and playing Toulouse and playing so well.
For sure. He's also, I've got a story about Blair. So the when the podcast started, like maybe a year and a half ago, I messaged Blair out the blue on Instagram, was like, this guy's never going to reply to me. I was like, he doesn't know me. Yeah. I'm just a random. He drove down without knowing me, without meeting me, from Edinburgh to Glasgow to do episode 2 of the podcast.
Right.
The podcast had no guests at that point.
What a good man.
Yeah. And he did it. Honestly, one of the most brilliant, like, funny guys I've been around.
Hilarious, isn't he?
Hilarious.
Hilarious, bro.
And like, super respectful, super nice.
It's a good boy. It's a really, really good guy. Really nice to have a drink with as well, genuinely. I mean, not that we drink as much anymore, but I'm just saying he's a good man to have a beer with.
Is there any stories about him that you can tell me, or is it?
It's not so much stories, but like, he's high energy like me. I would say we're both like ADHD people. Like I'm not diagnosing him, but we get along so well when we're on that time, you know what I mean? Because we're like high energy, we want to have fun. It's not so much yarns about him, but he can dance, Blair. I don't know if he's
I have heard it. He said that he'd done his Achilles in, and then he went to Ibiza. And because he was in Ibiza dancing so much, he stretched his Achilles back up. So he
was there actually, is a funny story I actually have about him getting injured on the piss. It was just before the World Cup, and we had gone out for a couple beers, me and him. And my partner's there, Lara.
Mm.
And it's... we're not overly drunk, you know what I mean? Not feeling overly bad, but I look behind me and Blair's on the ground. And like, we're on the line to get a beer, you know? Like, and he's going, "My knee, my knee." I was like, "What is going on here?" I was like, "This is unbelievable." Like, he just fell over. Like, he just literally was leaning on a pole and he fell over.
Mm.
So then I pick him up, we go outside. Lara, my missus, is consoling him. Famous thing is that he's like going up. This is just before we go to the World Cup, you know. Like 2-3 weeks before we go into the World Cup. If he's hurt here, it's catastrophic.
Yeah.
So he's doing like A skips and stuff like that. You know what I mean? Like on the side of the road, Lara, he's crying. I'm sure he won't mind me saying this. You know what I mean? He's crying. Lara's around him going, "No, it's going to be okay," and everything. Anyways, it all ends up being all right. He was overreacting as usual. but it was just a funny side that I had of turning around and seeing him on the ground going, "My knee!" But I love Blair, good fella.
He was telling me that Finn had a really bad accident with his head. I'm not sure if you remember this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then they went to, I think it was Magaluf or Ibiza, and all the boys were like, "Right, listen, everybody look after Finn because we can't have him hurting his head. He's really, you know, I think he cracked his skull or something." And then the first thing he does is dive into the shallow end of the pool and hits his head off and comes out and is like, "Oh, shit."
He's a mong, bro.
Alcohol will do funny things. Right. Best player in the world right now.
Wow.
Apart from yourself, of course.
Best player in the world right now. That's a hard question.
Yeah. There's so many amazing players.
Well, I would say it was DuPont before he got hurt. You know,
I was literally about to say that.
He probably still is DuPont. He's that freakish. I wouldn't be surprised if he's about to return in a week, you know? Look, he's the greatest to me anyways. Martin Honor's still playing. He's just signed to Toulon as a medical joker. And in my opinion, he's the greatest player to play in my position anyways. That's why I'll say he's the greatest. As an active player right now, I would say... it's tough, man. It's tough.
Difficult.
There's
so many amazing players at the moment. Yeah. I feel like this is actually like one of the best times for rugby that I can remember.
It's good, isn't it? Wow. Like guys like Peter Steph, Detoy and stuff like that, like he's up there for me, but I haven't seen him. I think he's been injured in Japan and stuff like that. So it seems injuries are getting everyone at the moment. Yeah. To put it on, I can't say Finn because he missed that kick. Well, right now, I'm going to say Ardy Salvaire with what he's doing at Moana and his leadership and everything like that. I'll say him anyways. But if not, if it wasn't for him, I'd probably say DuPont.
Who do you think the scariest player is in terms of someone running at you that you're just like, oh, for Christ's sake, I don't want to tackle you?
Wow.
Ezabeth is what I think Blair said.
He's massive, yeah, bro. Yeah. He's abnormally large, bro. Like, in rugby, boys are big, but like that's like kind of weird. Big,
yeah.
You
know?
Like, yeah. It's like a different planet, bro. Yeah. In terms of like Tui Sova's up there, he can run hard, you know, short, compact guy. Dewey as well. Yeah. I always say to Dewey, though, because his legs are so skinny. I'm chopping those things, you know what I mean? But he always says, come get them. Dewey be up there. Darcy's a nightmare as well, bro.
Yeah.
Because Darcy's so short and nippy. Mm. I'm so scared I'm going to high tackle him, one, if I get close to him, you know? God, like, I'm much more like Cheslin, Darcy. Those guys are harder to tackle than
the big guys.
Than the guys that come straight.
Yeah.
So I'd say Darcy or Cheslin or a guy like that, you know?
Darcy, it's so incredible watching Darcy with the ball.
He's special, eh?
Mate, it's unreal. Yeah. I remember talking to Darcy, I told you before this, like, oh, it must have been 4 years ago. And he was just starting. He was 19 at this point or something like that. Or maybe he was 21, something like that, because he's really young.
Yeah.
And he was just starting to break through. And seeing his development and seeing his, like, how... like just magic feet.
Yeah.
I love seeing it.
I like as well. Like he's a Hoik boy as well.
Yeah.
You know? Like
yeah.
The storyline about it, you know, like he's like just a kid from the borders.
And
he's got all this natural talent. It's sick, man. I'm really happy to see him doing well, you know?
Yeah. I just hope he doesn't get injured. He seems to like quite a lot of the
he's
time.
He's too twitchy for his own good. Yeah. He's too powerful.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Most awkward place you've ever dropped a fart.
That's crazy. Awkward, like
an elevator.
I'm not awkward like that. You know what I mean? Like I'm letting those rip in the elevator. Awkward. Jeez.
Podcast wouldn't even be that awkward.
I don't like plane farts, bro. I don't like
plane farts. Are pretty bad
It's just like I'm already uncomfortable up there, bro. Like it's just like. And like I'm already hot and sweaty. It's like someone farts up there, bro. Like,
and you can't tell who it is.
Exactly. But I start mean mugging everyone. I was like, okay, yeah, you want to fart, bro? Okay.
You want to play that game?
Yeah. I would say, and I have dropped one on a plane before. So that's the most all good place.
Okay. Okay. This is a good one. One player from an opposing side that you'd love on the Scotland team.
Wow. Okay.
It's quite an interesting one.
Mm. I would, and this is just after I've been talking about Blair. Give me Israel Folau.
Blair.
I grew up. Yeah, Blair, you're out of here, bro. I know. I just talked you up. You're out of here. You're out of here. Yeah, I'll take Israel Folau. Israel Folau is the most freakish rugby player that I've ever seen.
Mm.
I'll just take him, bro. You can't replicate it. A prime Israel Folau. And he came through the Melbourne Storm when I was young.
Hmm.
So when I was like 10, 9, 10, I was watching Israel Folau break the try scoring record when he was 18, you know? And then I watched him on the Lions tour when he played the Lions when they came to Australia and his battle with George North. Hmm. And oh, he's just such a superhero figure to me. It's like, I'm sure it's what people think LeBron James is in for like all the American kids over in America. That's what Israel Folau is to me. He's like abnormal talent. You know? I'd say him.
That's pretty good, actually. I'm trying to think of who I would take. I'd probably take DuPont.
Yeah, he would be good.
Just to have him there.
Ben White would be fuming though as well as the other nines. And they're real competitive and territorial about the positions where Blair can take it. Blair, you're out, mate.
Blair can take the shit.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm not really sure who this gent is. Why do you think Johnny Matthews isn't on the squad yet?
That's crazy to ask me. I don't know. I know he's. I don't. I'm not saying anything. No comment. Either way, I'm done here. You know. No, generally, I don't know. And that comes down to the thing I was saying about coaching before. Is like, so much stuff that we don't see. You know, I don't know anything about hookers. You know, I watch them. I just want them to get the ball in and the line out for me so I can get the ball, you know, or scrum well so I can get the ball. So there's, I don't know enough about that to make a comment.
Fair enough. Very diplomatic answer there. I like that. Okay. One last one. Right. So quick fire. Describe the following players in three words.
Three words. Okay.
Doohan van der Merwe.
Okay.
What's the first thing to say it?
If I'm being too honest, I'm gonna go pretend dumb. Like he acts dumb. He's okay. Not dumb. I know he's not dumb. I'd say pretend dumb. Genuine.
Hmm.
I know pretend dumb is two words, but we'll just go three. Genuine. And
there's a word on the tip of your tongue. Yeah,
I can't say that word. Genuine, and I would say angry.
Angry.
Yeah.
He did say that. He said that
you get angry weirdly as well. Yeah. Like competitively angry, where you have to like leave him. Hamish Watson's like that as well.
Is he?
Like, you know those people, the type of people that would ruin the mood to be competitive? He's like, you beat him at a game, a PlayStation game, and he just like, he gets that red face where he's like actually angry. You know what I mean? It's not like competitive angry anymore.
He takes
like
the time actually,
Yeah, Dewey's like that as well sometimes.
Yeah, he did mention that.
Yeah.
Finn Russell.
Finn, I would say generous.
Mm.
Fat. And I would say
Talented.
That's what, I want to say something about him is footy, but he gets told that enough.
He is talented.
He's also a good people person as well. Like he can talk to anyone. That's why I say he's generous, because he's generous with his time. Like he will speak to the person that's not playing and the person that he's comboing up with, you know, like 9-10 or whatever. He's got time for everyone. That's why I say I say he's generous.
Yeah. I think with him it's that he puts a lot more work than people see in.
Oh, like, 100%. He's one of the most misinterpreted athletes I think ever.
Yeah. Like people always say, who was it that was talking about this? Might have been Ali. Ali went in to go training. 4 hours later, he came back out and Finn was in exactly the same position, just watching games for like 4 hours.
Yeah.
And he just rewatching.
Puts a lot of work in, man.
Exactly. Okay, a couple more. Blair Kinghorn.
Blair. Skinny. Eccentric. Is that the word that I'm looking for?
Yeah. Eccentric's a good word.
And fun.
Fun.
It's fun to be around. Yeah,
it's good fun. He's like a ball of energy. He's like you. He's like a ball of energy. Jamie Batty.
Batman, my guy. Pilot.
Yeah.
Strangely. Reliable.
Mm.
Drinking. He loves drinking.
Yeah. I did not expect... I met him years ago in... where was I? In Magaluf. Yeah. I'm talking when I was like 17. And see now that he's a pilot. It's incredible, but also
I like strange. It. It's cool.
Yeah, it's really strange. Cool. Yeah, it's like his thing. He's found his thing.
I know.
Okay, last one. Darcy Graham.
Darcy Graham, geez. I don't know what the word for it is, but I've never met a guy who... I'm going to say it is. He's a grenade.
Yeah.
Like, he's so quiet and well-mannered throughout the week. The minute he goes out, grenade. Just like...
Hoik boy.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Like, he's so energetic and everything like that. Fun to go out with, though. So I'll say grenade. Twitchy. You know what I mean? He's a twitchy little thing. You know what I mean? And I would say... He always reminded me of Popeye.
Mm.
You know what I mean? You know the Popeye, the character that eats all his spinach? Little Jack, little sailor. Like, that's who he reminds me of. Just like small body, but like big heart. And you know what I mean? Like, Popeye.
Yeah. He does have a big heart, Darcy, as well. He's like an emotional, lovely guy.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? He's like, he wears his heart on his sleeve, Darcy. Okay, right. A couple more questions, then we'll cap it.
Yeah.
One that I was really wondering and I've always wanted to ask you, how did you deal with the. how do I put this? The influx of money coming in when a new contract comes in. Because sometimes people can get that, those paychecks, and it drives them, a bit mental. Like they start buying tons of shit. Like how have you dealt with that?
To be honest, if I'm speaking honestly, early in my career, not well. Mm. Like my dad always helped me with my finances by taking money off me, you know? Like
yeah, that's good though.
It was really good and making sure that I didn't spend all of it. But early on, like I was so into buying the things that I missed out on in my childhood, if you know what I mean? Mm. Like I wanted all the sneakers that I missed out on when I was young and all the clothes and stuff like that that probably my parents couldn't afford to buy me. And I caught up on all of that, you know, when I first got my first bit of money, and I feel that's died down now that since I've had a kid, but I still find time to, I think that's so important as well. Like I find that's my happy place of buying a new pair of shoes and making me feel good. And it's a hobby as well for me now. Like me and my partner, Lara actually used to work at Foot Locker and Hype and all the shoe stores back home. So it's always been a hobby of ours to
collect almost.
To collect, exactly. Yeah. And I'm always asking, you know, when my brother or my dad comes over to start bringing more and more of my shoes from back home so I can have them all here. But I would say I haven't always been the best, but now that I've become a father and I've realized I need to save some of this money for my son, and I've become a lot better with it, and I've seen, you know, a lot of help, and because I'm not really good with it. And I think that's the most important thing for athletes is that we're so caught up in being the best athlete that it's important to seek help, you know? And these are things that we're not given. You have to ask for.
You're not taught.
Exactly.
Yeah, you're not taught at school. Well, you shouldn't, you know, that this is what, you know, investment looks like.
Yeah.
This is what tax looks like.
Exactly, mate.
Like I was the same, you know, when I started getting jobs with camera brands, like with Canon and DJI, I didn't really understand taxes.
Yeah.
So genuine. Like, and my accountant had to be like, no, this, you need to pay this. Like, although you got, you know, let's make it up. Let's say you get £100. You don't actually get £100.
Yeah, exactly.
You get 60 quid.
That's my head in.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's why you need to seek help and ask people that do know what they're talking about. I feel like rugby in general is getting better with that by providing those things.
You
know,
it's brilliant.
To their athletes. So yeah.
Have you ever got into luxury watches?
To be honest, mate, and this is the funny thing, is that I've never owned a watch in my life. Genuine, never owned a watch in my life. And funny, Hamish Watson always used to get into me about it. It's like, I could see you in, sorry if I don't know the names, like, I could see you in the Day Date or the the bloody Two-Tone.
Yeah.
And I'd be like, and I started to listen to him because Hamish knows so much about his watches.
Hamish is a big collector,
really. Yeah. And I was going up to a time where I was going to get one and then I got scared. And I was like, no, that's way too much money. Just because I'd never spent money on a watch before in my life. So to be honest, man, I never owned a watch in my life. Yeah. And like, look at me now, I've never worn a watch, you know?
Yeah.
It's not part of my what. And it's not because I don't like them or anything that's like that. It's just that I've never spent money on it, you know? And, but I know heaps of the boys that do. And now Dewey's got the, I think it's like watches of Bath thing that he does. And he's always telling me like, look at these watches. No one's like, look so cool. And he does, to be fair. He looks really good, nice in them. So I'm sure at one point I'll get myself one, but I just don't know what or when.
Well, let me know. Honestly, let me know. I think the watches are a super nice thing. The reason that I like them is because they mark like a moment in time and you can pass them down.
Yeah.
You know, like one day, like the watches that I have, I want to give to my son or daughter.
Yeah,
And
a lot of them are good investments and stuff like that.
Oh, sure. Yeah, sure. Like, I know that there's some things I probably can't say. I know that, for example, Hamish came to a Vacheron event and we were talking about a ton of the watches that he's collected and a ton of the watches that I've collected, and a lot of them are pretty decent. Like they don't go down in value, which is awesome, which is really cool.
Because basically then you're wearing them for free, aren't you? Yeah.
Exactly. And you're getting the enjoyment as well. Yeah. Plus you're passing down something that has monetary value to your kid.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's like if times
are
tough.
It makes sense.
But yeah, let me know. I can see you. I'm such a Hamish kind of guy. I can see a Vacheron on your
wrist. Yeah, right. Explain to me what's a Vacheron.
Vacheron Constantin is like have you heard of the Holy Trinity?
No, never. You got to educate me, bro.
So the Holy Trinity is Audemars Piguet, AP.
Yes.
You've got Patek Philippe.
Yep, I know though.
And then you've got Vacheron Constantin.
Right.
So Vacheron Constantin is like, in my eyes, people will disagree with me here, the top of the top.
Right.
The production numbers are so low
and
the demand is
more
so
niche?
High.
Yeah.
Well, the demand is so high.
What's the price range compared to the other ones? Like,
so Vacheron, you could probably start at around 10 grand, but you could, some of the watches are like millions. Like you're talking. Genuine. I'm not kidding. Yeah, like right. One of one. You know, collector's pieces. Yeah. Like, and people pay that money for them. Same as Patek. Yeah. Patek start a bit higher, but same as Patek.
I've seen how much some of those watches are. It's crazy, eh? Mate, the NBA players and stuff are rocking them. Yeah.
Diamonds, like encrusted Rolexes.
Yeah. See, I'm not too sure if I liked all the iced out ones.
No.
I like, I tell you what, I was following this bloke on TikTok a while back and he was, he's basically goes to New York and London and he hunts, antique watches basically, like watches from the 60s and the 50s and stuff like that. Yeah. And I like how they look, eh? Like,
more vintage, not antique.
Vintage watches. And, like there were like vintage Cartier watches and stuff like that. And I really like how the older watches look, you know what I mean? And they're a bit slimmer, like a bit smaller as well. I'm not too sure how that would look on my wrist, but I like how some of those look, eh?
Yeah.
Are you into any vintage watches?
Yeah, so I've got I've got far too many.
Oh, really?
Like all my money, I shit you not.
Watches.
Like just what, like it becomes like a,
yeah,
I want a different color. I want a different this. I want a different metal.
Yeah.
But like, yeah, so I've got a bunch, but I do think that like the more people are going vintage now because it's like more unique.
Oh, right.
It's more like.
And would, are they cheaper?
Yeah, you probably are. Yeah, they probably are. They probably, depending on what you go for. Yeah. Like limited edition vintage Vacherons or Pateks are going to be a lot more expensive.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, they are. It's a good, I think it's a nice thing to like, I buy a watch whenever there's a memory attached to it.
Something happened, yeah.
Exactly. So like when the YouTube channel hits 100K, hopefully in a couple of months, there's a watch that I'm looking at and like, that's the watch I'll get. But yeah, you should try it. See before a big game or the Six Nations or a win. Like I would honestly do it.
Yeah.
Because it's also quite a good place to put your money as well.
Yeah, right.
Rather than like, I mean, in the bank, they're getting very little in the way of interest.
Yeah.
So it's pretty good to put it there.
Yeah.
Cars though. Have you got a car? Are you into your car?
I have a car now. And it's been like, I've been helped with it. You know what I mean? Like I've never bought a car, the really expensive car or anything like that.
What car have you got now?
I've got an X5.
Oh, nice. Nice.
So it's really nice, man. And Arnold Clark have helped me out with that. And
Nice.
And yeah, man, like it's the nicest car I've ever driven, you know? And it's quite funny though, because like I had a Holden Commodore back home, and that's like my Commodores are huge in Australia.
Yeah,
Commodores are massive in Australia. It's you either drive a Ford Falcon or a Holden Commodore, and it's just funny now that I used to drive my partner around in that Commodore, and even my Hyundai that I had just before I left. And you know, now we get in the X5, and I say to my partner, lean back a bit, I'll put the sunroof back and I have a laugh about it.
Yeah.
And it's just nice to share that with her that, you know, we got a nice car now. And even little things like that, you know, that's massive for me, you know. And I would never, like, it's not, like I said, nicest car I ever drove. So those little things mean a lot to me as well, you know, being able to take my family around in a nice car and like maybe, you know, hopefully one day get our dream house and stuff like that. Those are big things for me, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I think cars are, yeah, I know that Jamie Batty used to have his, do you remember he used to have a Mustang?
Oh, Mustang, yeah.
Oh, that was, I remember he used to come to the gym in this.
Cars are weird, bro. They just depreciate, don't they? Yeah.
So I got a Land Rover Defender 2 weeks ago.
Right.
And
like an old school one or?
The new ones.
Oh, fuck, that's unreal.
Yeah, so I was so excited about it. I got it delivered and I was like, oh, mate, like, the shapes, you know, it was the perfect color. It was the black. I was like, yeah. So I took it to mine. And you know how when you get a new car, you kind of get out the car and then you look at it and go like, yeah.
Yep, that's mine.
And then you get back into it.
Yeah.
So I go out the car, I'm looking at this Defender. And I'm like, that's awesome. Go back in it, turn it on. Screen doesn't turn on. And I'm
that's crazy.
You are fucking joking.
And
I called the garage and they were like, yeah, it's a pretty common fault in Defenders.
That's crazy.
And I was like, see to drive, the most comfortable, beautiful drive you'll ever have. See reliability of a Land Rover Defender, shockingly shit.
Right.
Dreadful.
Really?
So bad. Yeah, terrible. Like I know that I've bought that car because
for the
design.
Exactly. The way it looks.
I'm a photographer. I like that shit.
I like how some people are getting old Defenders now and doing them up. They look sick, bro.
Yeah, the banged up ones.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're really
cool. And like old school Defenders, I feel like have a real cool look to them, you know?
Yeah, they do. They're like more boxy. Yeah. Have you got a dream car? Like what is the...
To be honest, that'd be up there, to be honest. But I love, I like Porsches.
Oh, nice.
I just like the look of them. I like how... The shape of them.
Yeah.
And like, I don't know, I just, the Porsche is just like, yeah, it's awesome to me. Not a, like a, even like a 911 or something like that, but even like a Macan or something like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
I love all the shapes. I don't know the other one. Is it Cayenne or something like that?
Yeah, the Cayenne, the 4x4.
I like the way they look, bro. I just reckon everything Porsche looks nice.
I'm filming one of them this weekend in Sky.
Right.
Literally tomorrow, I'm filming with Porsche, but they are the shape
they're
of them.
Gorgeous, eh?
Oh,
yeah.
And the yellow, like they have yellow brake calipers and shit. It's,
sexy, isn't
they're
it?
Nice. Yeah. I remember Finn, we've gone so off piece. Finn got his, do you remember he got, was it a Lambo in France or something like that?
I can't, that doesn't surprise me. I remember he had the, was it the Aston Martin, the DBX thing?
Mate.
And he took me for a ride in that thing with doing monos.
Yeah.
You know, it's that powerful. That's the fastest car I've ever been in.
It's so beautiful, man. So beautiful. We've gone totally off.
Yeah.
So final question. What is next in your career? What is next for you?
Look, I'm hoping I can get back from this injury and be the same. I'll be a better player than what I was. You know, that's the start of my rehab. That was my goal. It's just that I'm going to come back better than what I was before. And if I can do that, I believe I'll be able to achieve all my dreams of winning with Glasgow again. And that's my goal. This whole rehab thing is I'll come back a better player than what I was when I got hurt.
Good, good. Well, listen, man, that's an hour in. I think that's like almost 2 hours.
Unreal, bro. We're chewing the fat.
Yeah. Thank you so much, brother. Honestly.
No,
and I've got a watch that I can give you right now.
Bullshit.
No, I've actually got a watch. So it's one of my ones that I got like ages ago.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking I could just give it to you. I never wear it.
Bro.
It's chunky. It's big. It's Casio, but it's still like worth a fair bit.
Really?
Yeah, of course.
Bro, mate, thank you so much. That's fucked up.
No, honestly, man. Like, seriously, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, bro.
Let me go and grab a... What to do is have a seat.
Because it's funny, bro, because I've never had a watch.
Yeah, that's exactly... Wait, have a seat. I'll get it. This is courtesy of Chisholm Hunter, right?
All right, perfect.
Give me 2 seconds. All right, brother.
Bro, it feels like Christmas, brother.
Bro,
thank
here
you.
Here you go. So this is... Let me describe it.
Unreal.
On mic so that people can actually know what it is.
Yeah. I'm chucking it on, brother. I'm chucking it on.
So, courtesy of Chisholm Hunter. So this, honestly, this is a Casio Mudmaster. So, story about this watch. We took this to Finland into like minus 30 to test it to like the extreme.
Yeah.
And it passed every single test we put it through.
Yeah.
And it's super chunky. You'll need to like set the time, the date and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I got you.
But yeah, super nice watch,
unreal,
man. It's yours.
Bro.
Yeah, go for it.
Thank
have it.
Thank you very much, man.
You need a watch on your wrist, man.
Exactly, brother.
Yeah, you need one. You need one.
This is sick, man. Actually, you know, all the kids in my... You know, I said, what's G-Shock?
G-Shock, can you put that mic just a little bit
more...
No, you're all right. Watch out, because it'll fall.
Yeah.
So G-Shock's basically...
Because, you know, the kids in my, when I was growing up, they used to wear the red, like, rubber G-Shocks. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So, interestingly enough, Casio and G-Shock are like the same. They're standalone, but they're the same, right?
Yeah, right.
G-Shock is the really rugged, tough Casio.
Yeah.
It is like they're like the military boys all wear this.
Yeah.
It's like that's the watch that the military guys will all wear.
Right.
But because that's so advanced, the one that you've got there, I think that's maybe like a grand you'll pay for that.
Really?
Like maybe a brand about, yeah.
Yeah.
It's pretty expensive, but
thank
it's like,
you, bro.
Mate, super nice watch. And I just want to say, I really appreciate you coming in.
Thank you so much, bro. I'm stoked with that. Thank you very much, brother.
Well, you can look at it and remember the podcast.
Exactly, bro. Now this is the first little moment.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you, brother.
No, you're welcome.